Tonight I want to speak on this remarkable word, grace. There's an American author named Philip Yancey who calls this word the last best word in the English language, because just about all the good words in the English language have been corrupted over the centuries, but he says this word hasn't been. The problem is, though, when you come to talk about grace, that many people misunderstand it and don't understand what it means. And in actual fact, it's not an easy word to explain, although it may be the last best word in the English language. And so, rather than trying to explain, attempt a definition, I want to read a story. It's not an original story. It's possibly the best known story in the Bible, and it's the story that Jesus told. It's in Luke chapter 15 and verse 11. Jesus also told them another story. Once a man had two sons. The younger son said to his father, "Give me my share of the property." So the father divided his property between his two sons. Not long after that, the youngest son packed up everything he owned and left for a foreign country, where he wasted all his money in wild living. He'd spent everything when a bad famine sped through that whole land. Soon he had nothing to eat. He went to work for a man in that country, and the man sent him out to take care of his pigs. He would have been glad to eat what the pigs were eating, but no one gave him a thing. Finally, he came to his senses and said, "My father's workers have plenty to eat, and here I am starving to death. I will go to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against God in heaven and against you. I am no longer good enough to be called your son. Treat me like one of your workers.' The younger son got up and started back to his father. But when he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt sorry for him. He ran to his son and hugged and kissed him. The son said, 'Father, I've sinned against God in heaven and against you. I am no longer good enough to be called your son.' But his father said to the servants, 'Hurry and bring the best clothes and put them on him. Give him a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. Get the best calf and prepare it so we can eat and celebrate. This son of mine was dead, but now has come back to life. He was lost and has now been found.' And they began to celebrate. The older son had been out in the field, but when he came near the house, he heard the music and dancing. So he called one of his servants over and asked, 'What's going on here?' The servant answered, 'Your brother has come home safe and sound, and your father ordered us to kill the best calf.' The older brother got so angry that he would not even go into the house. His father came out and begged him to go in. But he said to his father, 'For years I have worked for you like a slave and have always obeyed you, but you have never given me a little goat so that I could have a dinner for my friends. This other son of yours wasted your money on prostitutes, and now that he's come home, you ordered the best calf to be killed for a feast.' His father replied, 'My son, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we should be glad and celebrate. Your brother was dead, but he's now alive. He was lost and has now been found.'" Thank you. For some of you, the name of Ken Blanchard will be very familiar. Ken Blanchard is one of the leading business gurus in the Western world today. He's an American who's written a number of books on management, and his best known book is called The 1 Minute Manager. What a lot of you won't know is that just 2 or 3 years ago, Ken Blanchard became a Christian, became a follower of Jesus. And he tells the story of how Peter Drucker met him. Now, Peter Drucker is the management guru in the world. Peter Drucker is a Catholic, very active practicing Catholic. And he said to Ken Blanchard, "So," he said, "you've become a Christian." And Blanchard said to him, "Yes." Drucker said to him, "Why? Why did you become a Christian?" And he said, "Believe me," he said, "there's no better deal. No one else has grace. There's a story that's told that a few decades ago in England, there was a conference that was being held on comparative religion at Oxford University. And these people in this conference were having a discussion which got quite spirited about, is there anything really distinctive about the Christian faith? And some of them were suggesting it was the incarnation, that God came to us as a man. But others said, well, in other religions, the stories about gods becoming human beings as well. And someone said, well, it's the resurrection. And someone else said, yeah, but in other religions, there are stories about people rising from the dead as well. And so the discussion waxed on. And apparently there came a point in the discussion when C.S. Lewis walked in, who was the professor of English at Oxford. And he said, what's all the excitement? What's going on here? And they said, well, we're having this discussion about, is there anything really unique about Christianity, about the Christian faith? Is there anything? And Lewis said, well, yes. He said, that's easy. He said, it's grace. And grace is what the Christian faith is all about. But what is grace? It's not an easy word to define. There's a lot of words that we use in the English language that have spilled over from the word grace. We talk about someone being gracious. When a gracious person comes to us, they're kind and caring. They add value to a relationship. We talk about people being grateful, which means they're just overwhelmed with thanksgiving. We talk about getting something gratis, which means we get it free for nothing. We say grace at meals, which means we give thanks. We know what the opposite of grace is. It's disgrace. If you are in disgrace, you bring shame on other people. And in all these words, we get just the tiniest little glimpse of this last best word. Just little glimpses. Gracious and graceful and grateful and gratis. If you ask the question, what is it in life that brings us most joy? I think the answer is unearned gifts and unexpected pleasures. Something suddenly comes to us. We weren't expecting something, and suddenly we receive something. And we didn't expect it, we didn't earn it, we didn't deserve it, but somebody out of the goodness of their heart just decided to do something nice for us. And that is a picture of grace. There's something serendipitous is the word which is used now, but that's even more confusing. There's something unexpected, unearned, unmerited. It's been suggested that for some of us, romantic love is the closest experience we get to grace in life. That when you're in love, you suddenly think there's someone out there who thinks I am actually the most desirable, companionable, nicest person on the face of the planet. Wow. There's someone who actually lies awake at night and thinks about me. Why? Yeah, that's grace. Yeah, why indeed? I sometimes wonder. Here we are. If you ask the question, what is it that made Jesus so attractive to people? We're getting an understanding of grace. You see, it's an interesting thing when you read the Bible and you see the people who actually turned up to hang out around where Jesus was, what the impression you're left with is that the worse a person felt about themselves, the more readily they turned to Jesus. Now that's almost the complete reverse of how we feel today. If you feel real bad about yourself, you think, well, how could God love me? And sometimes people who are full of themselves, strong ego and so on, they think, well, I don't need God anyway. But here are these, as you read the Gospels, these people who felt really bad about themselves, and some of them were really bad people. You probably wouldn't want them as your neighbors. And yet the worse a person seemed to feel about themselves, the more readily they turned to Jesus. And that is grace. So what is grace? Grace is mercy. Grace is unmerited favor. Grace is kindness and goodness that we don't deserve, and grace is what God is about. And this is the last best word in the English language. But the problem is, almost no one understands grace. Over the years now that I've been in this ministry here, and years before that too, I've talked to how many hundreds of people, I've lost count, about grace, many of whom have not been Christians. Most of them, I suppose, haven't been Christians when I've been talking, trying to explain about grace. And I've realized how difficult it is for people to understand this. You know, the ordinary Kiwi bloke that I talk to may regard himself as a kind of self-made man. You know, I've got my life together, I've made of my life what it is. And so you talk to him about, well, the fact is, I mean, you can never ever do anything to earn favor with God. If you want to find God, the first step is to acknowledge you can never do it. And that's offensive to the self-made man who's got everywhere he's got in life by doing what he's done, his own way and his own strength. And here someone comes along and says, hey, if you want to know God, it isn't like that. You don't find God through self-effort. You find it through receiving his mercy and his unmerited favor and this amazing grace. Can't understand it. A lot of people have said that to me. And after all, every other religion in the world teaches something different. This is the core. Some people get greatly offended today about the uniqueness of Jesus, but it's the core of his teaching. If you become a Buddhist, you will have to follow the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. If you're a Hindu, you believe in the doctrine of karma, that you get what you deserve. In the Christian faith, you get what you don't deserve. It's actually totally the reverse. If you become a Muslim, you have to live by the Muslim code of law. I mean, every religion in the world is teaching what seems to be a self-evident truth. If you want to find God, it will come about through your own self-effort and your own self-improvement. Now, the trouble is, I've met a lot of Christians who believe this is what the Christian faith is about. Possibly most Christians believe this. Maybe people understand that, okay, if you're going to come to Jesus in the first place, you've got to acknowledge that it can only be because of the mercy and the unmerited love of God. But having come to Jesus, I think now everything depends on my being obedient to God. And so you get Christians running around who are as miserable. I was going to say as miserable as sin. That's not quite... who are deadly miserable people. Because there's nothing joyful about trying to live under the law. Trying as hard as you can to earn the obedience, earn favor with God through your own obedience. You can't do it. It's miserable. Why try? Other people say, you know, I've heard people say that sometimes some people think that the biggest possible hindrance in people coming to faith is the lack of grace they find amongst the followers of Jesus. You see, because Jesus spent 3 years, he called this bunch of fellows together, and this group of men, his closest disciples, and this group of women as well. Amazing group of people. And he showed them this new lifestyle, and it was all about grace. They were gracious, or they learned to be gracious people, to be grateful. And this had an overwhelming impact. This little group of people was to change the history of the world, because there was something about the quality of life that these people had found that had a huge ripple effect outwards, which was to impact finally the whole Roman Empire. And when it crumbled and the political structures fell, what was there was the Christian church. And it has outlived scores of political systems down through 2,000 years, and it will continue to outlast political systems of humans. This was the mark of this community. So that when you go into a community of the followers of Jesus, genuine followers of Jesus, one of the things that hits you, here's a bunch of graceful people. They are motivated and they are energized by this amazing thing. They're not all having to try and prove to each other that they're good enough to earn each other's favor, but they graciously put up with each other's weaknesses and shortcomings, and they love each other and they care for each other, and they have these attitudes out into the world. And that's Jesus' vision for the world, a redemptive community that has this amazing impact, full of grace and mercy and truth and love. But it isn't like that for everyone. I heard the story about a woman who really had messed up her life. And someone said to her, "Would you like to come to church?" You know what she said? "I already feel terrible about myself. They just make me feel worse." Philip Yancey, who I mentioned before, has written this book on what's so amazing about grace. He said he grew up in a church in the States where he said people spoke a lot about grace, but they lived by the law. And he said they used to make rules about the length of girls' skirts and the lengths of boys' hair. And they thought these things were important. And he said, "I rejected the church for a time because I found so little grace there. I returned because I found grace nowhere else." There's a counselor named David Siemens, and he says that he believes the two major causes of emotional problems among Christians, number one is the failure to receive and to live by grace, and number two is the failure to give grace away to other people. You know, if this thing about grace is to grip our hearts, this is the most liberating, the most empowering. The human heart longs for grace more than anything else. Is there someone who loves me in spite of all the failings that I know I have, in spite of the image I try to project to other people, in spite of all the stuff that goes on in myself? Am I actually loved? Loved at the core of my being? And this is what is so utterly unique in the Christian faith, this resounding call that echoes really through the cosmos. The answer is yes. David Siemens again, he says that there's a lot of Christians, he said, who believe a good theology of grace, but they don't live by it. They've never let it get, though they believe it in their head, they've never let it get to their emotions. Now, the interesting thing about grace is that when you read the teachings of Jesus, he never used the word. The word actually started being used by his followers because they were trying to find just one word that could describe this man. What is one word that you could use that would explain the teaching of Jesus? So when John, for example, came to write his gospel at the beginning and he gave a little summary about the teaching of Jesus, this is what he had to say. This is John chapter 1. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." You spot it? Four times over. The one word that echoes as a refrain. If we want to talk about this man, you know, who came from God, who was involved with the creation of the universe, who came to live amongst us, what word do we use? It's this amazing word of grace. Thank you. So what did Jesus do? If he never used the word, what did he do? Well, first he did two things. The first thing is that he told story after story after story about grace, about a God who loves, who has an extravagant love. The endings of Jesus' stories about grace are just too good to be true, or maybe they're so good that they must be true. Let's put the one up, the most famous one up again. Jesus told them another story. Once a man had two sons. The younger son said to his father, "Give me my share of the property." So the father divided his property between his two sons. I was reading, there was some folk who in the Lebanon who were asking some Lebanese, who in modern day Lebanon, very close to where Jesus would have been telling the story, where the way of life hasn't changed very much over the centuries. And they said, "When you read this story, what really hits you about this story?" And they said two things. Number one was in this verse here, verse 12. The younger son said to his father, "Give me my share of the property." And they said, it is inconceivable in the Middle East that anyone would ever do that, that any son would be so insulting to his father, because you didn't get your share of the property until the father died. In other words, the son was saying to his father, "Dad," he said, "I want you dead. I want you out of the way." And that's the background to the story. This son, he hated his father. He hated his father and he wanted nothing to do with him. "Dad, I wish you were dead." That's what he's saying. And then the other thing they said was in verse 20, the thing that struck them. When the younger son finally came to his senses and he starts going back to his father, when he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt sorry for him. He ran to his son and hugged and kissed him. And they said no one in his position, being a wealthy landowner, would ever run and humiliate himself in public like that. Never. You know what this story is saying? Is that's how God forgives. He humiliates himself in public. He comes running to us to say, "I want to forgive you." When Jesus hung on the cross and was humiliated publicly, this was God saying to us, "My love is all about mercy and unmerited favor. You don't deserve to be forgiven, but I forgive you." The father lost his dignity. You know, if you ask most people, how do you get to heaven? The answer's reasonably odd. People say, well, you've got to be good. You'll be good enough to get there. But that isn't what Jesus says. The answer in getting to heaven is not to be good, but to cry help. And that's what the son did. Out in the pigsty, he thinks, what have I been doing? What a mess I've made of my life. Help. There's a preacher named Fred Craddock who was just recently preaching on this passage. And he did a very interesting thing. He altered the end of the story as he was telling the story, because there were two sons in the story. The older son, who'd always been faithful and obedient to his father, stayed on the farm. And as this fellow Craddock was preaching this message, he got to the end of it. And he changed the end of the story so that at the end of the story, the father kills the fatted calf and throws a party for the older brother as an expression of thanksgiving for his lifetime of faithfulness and obedience. And as he was preaching this, he said there was someone at the back of the church who shouted out, "That's how it ought to be." And that's how most of us would think. One son was a waster. He wanted his father dead and out of the way. He wasted his money on wild women and this kind of stuff. And here's the other son. It's hardly a message on family values. And this is the shock, the scandal of grace. That on the one who was so obviously undeserving, the love and the mercy of the Father was poured out. And that's God's message to you. You may feel I'm undeserving of God's love, and you are. And so am I. You know, if you want to go to a really important person, if you're asked to meet the manager of a big corporation, or someone who's, you know, feels they're really important in life, I mean, you go, they summon you, you know, and you go to their office and they're sitting waiting for you. And you would think, well, with God, surely it's like that. But you know, God has actually taken the first step and he's come to us in humility. as a servant. And that's grace. I love you. You're undeserving of my love, but I love you. God welcomes home all who will come, and he's made the first move. So that was the first thing Jesus did. He told story after story after story. And the second thing, the supreme demonstration of grace, is that he went to the cross. There was an American Methodist missionary named E. Stanley Jones who spent his life in India. And he says that when someone says to me, all religions are the same, my mind runs to the cross. There is no other authentic note of divine self-sacrifice in any other religion. And he wrote that comment in a book called Christ at the Round Table because he'd spent a great deal of his life in dialogue in India with Hindus and Muslims and people out of a lot of other religions in that deeply, deeply religious country. There is no other note, he says, of divine self-sacrifice in any other religion. And he tells a story about a man in India, quite a significant leading sort of a person apparently, who had become a Christian. And Stanley Jones asked him how this had happened, and he said, well, he'd married a woman. This woman had become a Christian, and he said she lived a life deeply trusting of him. But he'd gone off overseas on a business trip, and he'd become involved with another woman. And he came back, and he saw the love and the trust of his wife, and this ate him up inside. And eventually a crisis came and the whole thing was going to come out in the open. And so he took the initiative and he told his wife. And he said he saw what happened to her, the anguish and the pain that gripped her as what he was saying to her. He said she collapsed down on the bed. And then he said she stood up and she said to him, I love you and I love you still. And I will never leave you. And he said, when I saw in the anguished love of my wife the meaning of the cross, he said, I was a redeemed man from that hour. And what did he see? What did he see? He saw unmerited love. He saw undeserved forgiveness. He said in this account that I read, he said he was expecting the storm to break over his head and his wife to say all manner of things and in all probability to leave him. He could see the pain that he had inflicted, the terrible pain, and yet shining through the pain, he saw the love. And that is grace. And in seeing the love, he had an understanding of what his Christian friends had been trying to tell him about the cross. And in seeing the cross, he said, from that hour I became a redeemed man. Now that is grace. You don't deserve the forgiveness of God, and neither do I. There's two ways to find God. One is to become part of some religious system that teaches you've got to do this by your own effort. You've got to struggle and try as hard as you can. And I tell you this, with all the best will in the world, that you'll never ever make it. Never. The other way to find God is to cast yourself on the mercy of a God who loves us in a way which is totally undeserving. And this is the power of the cross. Stanley Jones says that Muslims and Hindus said to him that a God who would suffer cannot be perfect. They said, we cannot believe in the Christian God because any God who would suffer can't be perfect. And he said, I used to say back to them, imagine a community that was stricken with a plague and there was a doctor who had the cure to the plague. And he said, I will not run any risks myself becoming immersed in this community. Or he said, imagine a community that was plagued with ignorance. And there was a very wise teacher. And this teacher said, I won't go and be part of them. Or there was a community that was plagued with famine. And there was someone who had a lot of food and said, I'll do nothing. I won't be part of this. Or there's a community that's evil and there are good people who say, we will do nothing. Is that really perfection? And others may believe in gods who sit remote in the heavens and have no involvement with humanity, but that is not how Jesus, that's not what Jesus told us that God was like. I want to close with a story I heard from another pastor who, he and his wife had a daughter who was, at the age of 15, was on taking birth control measures, and some nights she never came home. And this was breaking the heart of he and his wife. And one night he stood at the front of their house looking out through the front window, gazing out into the night. And he said he felt so angry. Here was his daughter. She was destroying her own life. He was upset at the pain it was bringing to the relationship with he and his wife. And he said, I so much wanted to be like the father in the prodigal son in the story. But he said, all I could do was just feel so angry about this pointless waste of a life, and how on every occasion, every time they talked about it, there'd be a violent argument and she would always get the better of the argument. And he said it just made him so angry. Apparently he stood there for hours just gazing out the window into the darkness, and then finally, small hours of the night, she came home. And he said, when finally she came home, all he said I wanted to do was run up to her and fling my arms around her and tell her how much I loved her and how much it grieved me and how much I really wanted the very best for her. And he said, I realized I was a helpless, lovesick father. You know, that is the message of the Bible, that God, the creator of the universe, is a helpless, lovesick father who tonight is waiting for your response of love. Tonight we've seen a number of people who've responded to the love of God and become followers of Jesus. They've invited Jesus into their life. And tonight, this could be your night. Because of the wonder of grace, there's only two things you can do. If someone demonstrates to you undeserved love, there's only two responses you can make. One is to respond out of utter thankfulness and gratitude, and to receive the wonder of this love into your heart. And the other one is to turn your back and walk away and say, I will have nothing to do else. I will have nothing to do with this. There is actually no intermediate option. Now, a lot of people say, there's got to be a third option. I believe all this, but I just don't want to get involved. To do nothing is to say no. And so tonight, I'd like to invite you to make a response and to say yes to the lovesick Father.